Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Happy Independence Day, Stephen.
One day late, but that's just great. We decided to kind of put it off from last night, Phil, didn't we? Primarily for us to go, we're going to see, a fireworks display last night. I wanted to ask you, was anybody doing fireworks in Colorado last night?
You know what? Very few. Almost all of the shows got closed down. I think there were a few in highly controlled, highly concrete urban settings like Invesco Field at Mile High or whatever it's called these days. I can't even remember
now.
It's not Invesco. Sports Authority Stadium or whatever they're calling it. They did one. There was one at the baseball stadium. And other than that, everything had been closed down. And remarkably, I found it remarkable anyway. All of my highly sophisticated neighbors who are usually firing stuff off to all hours of the night, they refrained as well. So there were no professional shows, and people were not having their amateur shows. People were really, truly concerned about not setting off any more wildfires. And good news, speaking of the fires in Colorado, they just heard that the Waldo Canyon fire, the one down in Colorado Springs that was so destructive, is now 90% under control. So
that's right. That is wonderful. How's the Air Force Academy? I wanted to ask about that. Was it spared?
It was spared. It came out of it okay. There's some damage to the grounds, is my understanding.
Right.
But none of the major structures were lost, and they've resumed the program. You know, this was actually occurring the same week that the new cadets are inducted. One of our listeners, Sean Key, was talking about his son had just gone down to the Air Force Academy and was concerned about what was going on down there, since there was also, you know, the same day his son was there, the news was they were evacuating the Air Force Academy. But things are back to normal. People have been sent, those whose homes have survived, most people are now back in their homes, and you know, now there's this long process of trying to get things back to normal that's starting.
Well, that's wonderful, and I'm so glad. And but that was one of the fires. That was the biggest of the fires in Colorado that they have to contain mostly.
You know, actually, I believe the one up north, the one that hit Fort Collins, is even bigger. I think this is the most destructive, and it was the one that has come closest to Denver, so it got more press for that reason too. But of the eight, I believe most of them are now largely contained, although the air quality is still quite bad, even here in town. Yesterday, we went out, and it was just like, I mean, you would think it was fog, right? You can't see the mountains off in the distance. You see the sun, and it's like it's behind a heavy cloud, and you go, those aren't clouds. You know, it's just the smoke lingering in the air. But all that smoke is probably a good sign, because it means that the fires are going out. So,
yeah.
We're
hoping for the best for you guys, and the entire state, really the entire West, get some rain. You guys need some rain terribly, and that would help things a lot.
That's what I've been saying for like 2 weeks. Is like, all we need is a freak cold front to set in. Just, you know, one of these like 2 or 3 days of really strong rain and cold temperatures, and would take care of it. You know, it just happens. I mean, it's not coincidental, but the whole thing was concurrent with a heat wave, and it only makes sense. Well, plus we've had this terrible pine beetle infestation in the mountains for years, essentially turning large swaths of the forests in the mountains into essentially kindling wood. I mean, it just dried out dead trees waiting for something like this to happen, and it finally happened. I don't know if you saw, actually, over on PJ Media, Rand Sinberg had a good rundown of the current forestry practices that probably contributed to all these terrible fires, and it's a very interesting reading, very very eye-opening. Bob Zubrin wrote about that. He's a Coloradan. You know, just a lot of things that would have been done in the past aren't done now because we have this more green, natural approach to forestry. And because we have this more green, natural approach, there's this let things take its course. Time was they would have gone in and they would have clear-cut out all that beetle-killed wood. And
here in Louisiana, we do a lot of controlled burning. I mean, they just burn the underbrush and that seems to help keep us from having the huge forest fires. But then again, we're semi-tropical down here and lots and lots of water. So, you know, you're just not going to see the same kind of wildfires in a place like that as opposed to out west. So, anyway.
Yeah, well, it's a good idea. I think it goes to show you that, I mean, one of the things we were talking about a couple weeks ago is how fire is this, low-tech thing that there's not much we can do about. Well, it's possible that there are things we can do about, and we haven't been doing them very well, that maybe even 50 years ago we were better at controlling fires than we are currently because there's been this kind of philosophical shift in how it's addressed. And it's very, you know, it actually touches upon our discussion with Colin McInnes from last week talking about the sort of misanthropic approach to the world that the green movement sometimes takes, you know, the idea that humans shouldn't be allowed to touch anything, that anything we touch we're going to destroy. Well, in point of fact, an awful lot of forest could probably have been saved, and a lot of animals' lives. I mean, even if you don't care about human life or human property or any of that other stuff, a lot of animals died in the most horrible way possible in these fires over the last few weeks, and it could have been prevented if you let, you know, human beings be human beings and interact with nature in the way that we do. But we live and we learn, I hope, and perhaps this will be a wake up call to reevaluate how forestry is done. But anyway, we veered far from our subject, which was the 4th of July. So tell me what went on down your way. I assume fireworks and all the normal festivities.
All the normal festivities. We visited with some friends earlier in the day and just had a good time with the kids. They we had this large slide thing that all these kids were, you know, running up and down all morning long until they just flat ran out of steam. It was so funny. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, after having done it all day long, they were just—I was the end of it. And you know, it was difficult waking them up to go see fireworks. But that was just completely zonked from having spent the entire day running and playing and having a good time. So, yeah, it was a good day. It was fun. We had a good time, and I hope that y'all did as well. A day like yesterday is, we're just doing whatever we want, which is what freedom is about, I guess.
There you go. Exactly right. Yeah, celebrate our, as I always like to say to my British friends, celebrate America's throwing off British tyranny, right, by
right.
You know, burning some hot dogs on the grill and watching things blow up. I mean, it's just... It doesn't get much better than that, actually. And it's perfect. Wednesday, you know, everybody was complaining because it was on Wednesday, and it made it impossible to build a weekend around. Actually, it's not impossible. You just have to take 2 days to make a nice 5-day weekend out of it. But really, I think this is a good model for a work week, don't you think? It's like, work a couple days, have a day off, work a couple days, take a couple more off, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I've had 2 weeks within one, and I don't know, I don't feel like I've been any less productive this week as a result of that day off. I really don't. But
I don't think I have either. Which maybe says something about how productive we typically are. I don't know, but we'll move quickly on from there. So
hey,
speaking of Independence Day,
anything of any importance at all that happened? that might have been announced in the last couple of days. It seems like there was something.
Oh, we've got big science stories we're gonna get to, and I know you've got one in your secret bag of tricks. I've actually got one too, and we'll see if it's the same one. So we've got Higgs boson to talk about, and I've got one, and you've got one. So we'll see if we've each got a secret surprise story that's different from the other guys. But meanwhile, let's stay with Independence Day, and let's talk a little bit about the Declaration of Singularity. Now, you and I were talking about this, I think, on Monday, and I think we've never actually talked about this thing on the show before. Is that possible that we never have?
No. We've mentioned the Declaration of Singularity on the show. I know for a fact we did it last year.
Oh, did we?
Oh yeah.
Well, we mentioned okay. It. See, that my failing memory serves me well, right?
it is good enough, and it deserves to be brought up every year, as far as I'm concerned. So.
Oh, fair enough. Okay, nice recovery there, Stephen. Okay, good. I don't remember what we've said about it in the past, but gosh, I've been putting this thing up. I know for 4 years, maybe 5 years now. This is the Declaration of Singularity is my. First off, loving tribute to the Declaration of Independence. I get some feedback on it sometimes where people think I'm like I'm bad-mouthing the Declaration of Independence, and nothing could be farther from the truth. Okay, that's the first thing I want to say is, to me, that I would use it for this purpose shows that I think that the Declaration of Independence is a foundational, fundamental, extremely important document. Okay, so I want to get out of the way that my rewrite of the Declaration of Independence is not out of any dislike of the existing Declaration of Independence. My point being that the American Revolution was in its own little way a singularity, was its own discontinuous change that occurred in the world, a movement of a people saying we have decided that we are a nation. We're not a nation of men. We're not a nation defined by a race or even really by geography, but defined by these ideas that unite us. That we have a philosophy of who we are and what we want to be, and that makes us a separate people, and therefore we're no longer going to be part of this other country that we used to be part of, because we get to set our own future and we get to be the people that we want to be. It's a shocking idea in the history of the world. No one had ever done anything quite like that before. And I think it foreshadows a good deal of some of the kinds of things that, oddly enough, that we talk about on this program. So I took the Declaration of Independence and rewrote it as the Declaration of Singularity, and it's obviously fake. I mean, there will never be such a document because, for one thing, when we think about the singularity occurring, and we've talked many times about all the different definitions that might be applied to the singularity, the intelligence explosion, or the emergence of greater than human intelligence, or whatever definition you want to use for the singularity, we tend to think of it as something that will just occur, right? One day the singularity won't be happening, and the next day it will. No one will have thrown a switch necessarily, or said, "Okay, singularity now." And in this document that I've created here, the Declaration of Singularity, that is what's happening, right? The intelligent beings have gotten together and said, "Here's what we're going to do from now on. We're no longer part of this previous civilization that existed, this post-industrial world. From now on, we're going to be this new post-singularity world, and here's what it's going to be." It's actually it doesn't come nearly as far as some people would like it in terms of saying what the new world is going to be. What it does talk about is why we had to break, right? why a change had to occur. And what I like about that is that's the trick with
the singularity, though, is that we don't know what post-singularity beings would want to do. So,
right,
you know,
right.
It's we can't say with any authority or any any basis what that it would be, but we can sure talk about why they might want to make the break. So, yeah, you stuck with what we actually could talk about, which is probably wise.
But when you think about it, the analogy is correct, because the existing Declaration of Independence does not lay out an awful lot of specifics about how the United States of America would really work.
Right.
And the Constitution didn't show up for 13 years after the Declaration of Independence. So it took some time to figure out exactly, you know, what we were going to be and how we were going to be. We knew we were a people, and we knew that we had fundamentally different ideas about how the world should work than Great Britain did, irreconcilable differences with them, all men are created equal, those kinds of big shocking ideas, different enough that we had to say, that's it, we're our own nation. And then the details showed up later. Well, the same thing is here with the Declaration of Singularity. We know that things have got to change, and here's why. And it's one of the most interesting things when you read the real Declaration of Independence. You often forget. I mean, people rarely get past the first couple of lines, but I make a habit of I read it every year, right around the fourth. One of the interesting things about it is the meat of it, really, is this laundry list of grievances against King George. It's like, here's why we had to go, folks. And not just King George, but what today we would call, you know, the King George administration, right? I mean, it's against him and his government. All the things he's been doing, you know, quartering soldiers in our homes without asking us. He's putting taxes on us. He's without letting us be represented in Parliament. This and that, and the other thing, and I think that's likewise what we tend to do when we think about what we're looking forward to in a post-singularity world, and I try to capture some of that here in listing out our grievances against this current age we live in. So I'll just read those. I just want to read the list, and Stephen, you can tell me if I left anything off, because I always feel like there's a lot more that could have been added. So let me just read that one section of the Declaration of Singularity. Such has been the patient sufferance of these beings, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former civilization. The history of the present post-industrial age is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the prevention of the further evolution over these states of being. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. In the face of unrelenting progress, this civilization has continued to hearken back to, quote, natural limitations of development which must never be challenged. Actually, it's the exact kind of thing we're dealing with talking about the forest fire issue, isn't it? It has promoted and enforced harmful and prejudicial distinctions between human and non-human intelligence. It has set artificial and arbitrary limits as to duration of lifespan. It has enforced meaningless distinctions between labor and leisure. It has equipped despotic governments and enterprises to restrict the means of production and self-expression to a limited few, and it has promoted the creation of artificial boundaries between creative minds. To me, those anyway are the headlines, right? Those are the barriers that we see coming down with the singularity. Are there other things I could have thought of?
You know, it's fun to watch these things come down, isn't it? I mean, for example, one of my favorites that we've seen come down in the years that we've been doing the show and doing the Speculus is that, you know, now there's, you know, it's promote. We have now the ability to produce and there's the opportunity for self-expression for everybody. You know, I mean,
yes,
that's the power of the internet is that, you know, we don't have just, you know, a small group of people say in distant cities making all the entertainment and all the news and everything, and then feeding it to the rest of the country and much of the world. Instead, everybody's got a voice now. And, you know, there are people that, you know, say, this is just too much. You know, I mean, we don't speak with one voice anymore. I say, good riddance. I'm glad we don't think that's boring when we speak it with one voice. We are a diverse people. We have a diverse set of opinions. You know, put it all out there in the marketplace of ideas, and may the best ideas win. And you can't have that if you just have one idea out there being handed down from on high. You have to have, you know, a healthy marketplace of ideas has to have participation from all levels. And, you know, that has been, to me, something that has been very, very fun to watch. It has been something that over the last 5 years, it is just, it's just come alive.
And it's astounding, isn't it? It really is.
It's really astounding. And I'll give you one small example is For example, the Kindle. It's not just the device that I use to read. It's also a publishing system whereby anybody who has an idea for a book can pretty much can get it out there on the Kindle. And we'll have PJ Manning on the show here in a few weeks to talk about her her Kindle book that is coming out this summer. And one of the things I want to ask about is not just the book itself, which is, you know, it sounds like it's going to be awesome, but but also the experience of, you know, how do you publish a book with Kindle? And I'm interested in knowing that, and I'm sure she'll have a lot she can share with us on that as well. So, yeah, that to me is an exciting thing that we've seen happen in the last, I would say, I'd be tempted to say the last 10 years, but really it seems like it's really picked up speed in the last 5 years.
It has. It has. I mean, the advent of the web, actually the advent of computer technology generally, has become this huge channel by which people could, as you said, you know, find their voice, express themselves in ways that were never available before. And it goes not just to getting your ideas out there, but one of the things mentioned there in the declaration is the means of production. And this is the other thing that, that we've seen happen, is that regular people are able to produce things that at one time only large enterprises or governments could produce. Now, up to now, that's been largely information products, but with this huge wave of the maker movement and 3D printing, that is now moving into the material world as well. And, you know, an awful lot of the changes discussed in the Declaration of Singularity, I think, will have happened before the actual singularity gets here. So, so in some ways, we're talking about, well, I guess that's true. The revolution had already started by the time by the time they signed the Declaration of Independence, hadn't it? So I guess the analogy, yeah. The analogy still holds up. But it really is fun to watch. To watch this unfold, and it'll be fun over the next few years to see how much more dated this becomes, and possibly we'll think of other we'll think of other things, major sweeping changes that that will help kind of define what we're working away from or working towards in stating that that the singularity has happened. One of the things that's kind of interesting about this is I wonder if we could see what things will be like 10 years from now. Right, and as futurists, we should have some idea of that. But if we could actually see what is going, what the world will be like a decade from now, if from where we sit right now, would we look at that, Stephen? Do you think, and go, "Oh, that's it. It's occurred." Right, that's a post-singularity world.
Well, I don't think any one thing is the thing. Will be the thing that tells us that we've reached the singularity world. One thing I think that we will definitely see in the next 10 years is that will change the world, I believe, as much as cell phones have changed the world, you know, in the last 10 years. And really, I'm not talking about the bricks that used to be carried around early 90s and things, but really the cell phone that everybody now has in their pocket. And it being a smartphone that you can get on the internet with and everything, that one thing has been huge. That has been a huge change in the last 5 to 10 years.
Game changer for the whole world, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, we've had people on the show telling us about the Psy Warrior with the smartphone, you know, and how that you know, this absolutely changes a continent, you know, that. Formerly called a dark continent, it's not so dark anymore.
That's right.
It's, you know, a lot of knowledge is everywhere now. But I think that something that will be as big potentially, auto drive automobiles. And you know, we laugh. Well, why in the world would that be big? Well, it will free up the world to be where you need to be. Pretty much any time, and here's my thought about that. If you're not concerned about the drive, okay, you're going to be places that you're not now, okay. If you just get in the car, you can spend the day working while your car is taking you to wherever you need to be for the next day. You know, it just Well, it's the, I think that you'll see a new group of nomadic workers that a new lifestyle will come out of that. And, you know, will it be good for the planet? Well, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same kind of cars we're driving now. It doesn't necessarily have to be gasoline cars. But I think we're going to see that. That's a big deal. And Ford is talking about, well, we'll have them within 5 years for the interstate. Ford announced this week that for interstate driving, they'll be putting out auto drive cars in 5 years. 5 years is nothing. In the development cycle of a car, that's just the next thing they're going to do. You know,
right.
I mean, that's just right around the corner. So, that's coming. And then, I predicted. So 5 years we see that. 5 years after that, it'll be auto drive everywhere all the time. And the question then becomes, will we be allowed to drive if our cars do it so much better than us and so much safer? Would it be something that would be unreasonably dangerous to take the wheel if cars are 10 times safer, if the auto drive cars are 10 times safer than we can be? It's some interesting legal questions are going to have to be answered with that.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge conundrum sorting through some of those issues. But assuming that in 10 years that chasm has largely been leapt, that we actually have arrived in a world where primarily people are driving around in self-driven cars, I think that is one of the most recognizable things you would look at and go, wow, that's so different. The world is so weird now. Looking at it from here. The other one will be our iPads, iPhones, whatever the devices will be 10 years from now, and we don't know what they'll be, whether they'll even be visible. Maybe they will.
We've got an idea about that. Google Glass, have you been keeping up with the news on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, but I think it'll be pretty different from even that by 10 years from now.
You're talking about Google contact lenses and maybe even surgery at that point.
It could be implants at that point, or who knows, maybe a little nano swarm flying around your head. That seems farther out to me probably than 10 years. but the idea that device will by then, assuming that the conversational user interface shows up as planned, will be this being, this entity in your life that you have this relationship with, in a way that you currently have a relationship with another human being. I think those will be the two big things. If you look at that world from here, you say, man, if that's not the singularity, that's much closer. That's a weird world. That is a drastically different world. That is a dramatically different world. Whereas 10 years from now, Stephen, when we're living in that world, assuming we're still doing this show, we'll be able to look back and then go, well, you know, that's pretty cool, but it's no bigger a deal than the iPad was, right? I mean, it's like, but that's not singularity, you know, it's just self-driving cars, no big deal. I mean, they've been around for weeks.
Things always look more awesome before you have it. I don't know what that is. That's I think that's human nature. You know, it's just once you have it, it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, it's what keeps us moving forward. We never reach that crescendo where we go, that's it, that's all the cool stuff we need, right? We don't need any more cool stuff. A really interesting comment from Thuris in the chat room. Actually, first, I need to note that Jab has pointed out that the 4th of July in Japan means all you can eat chicken at KFC. So I have got to arrange to be in Japan one of these years on the 4th of July, because I will close one of those places down, I guarantee it. Yeah, you know, you guys, you've made a big mistake, let me tell you. So Thuris says that the opposition to, or just indifference towards, transhuman and high-tech progress may be even harder to surmount than the colonies' grievances, because our current difficulties are more a matter of stubborn moral/ethical/temperamental differences. Then he says, of course, once people have the easy, fun, amazing stuff in front of them, it's safe to assume a lot of the objections will melt away. Well, I wonder about that. You know, Stephen, you were just talking about all the big legal difficulties, but people can be awfully hard-headed, can't they? I mean, I wonder if the big problem will be legal, or more just that a lot of people say, we're not ready for this. Perhaps legal infrastructure will be used to slow things down. But what do you think? Do you think there's a risk of somebody putting on the brakes?
No, I don't. I don't think that's going to happen. It's just going to be too darn, you know, I put it this way. There have been efforts in various states to outlaw the use of cell phones while driving.
Right.
Okay. That's really not gone anywhere, has it?
No.
I can tell you, I've seen the numbers, I've studied it. It's sort of what I do, okay?
Yeah.
And it turns out that driving while on a cell phone is equivalent to driving with about 3 or 4 beers in you, okay? As far as your tendency to have an accident, it's just that bad. It's as bad as that. And it's amazing how much putting that cell phone to your ear takes you out of the mindset of, you know, perhaps I should watch the road. Even if you're looking, you're still looking down the road, it's like your brain is elsewhere. And
right.
And accidents happen as a result. You know, how awesome will it be when, you know, your car's doing the drive and you're on your cell phone, you're watching TV, you're
right.
cruising the internet, you're doing productive work, you're playing, all these things that are just flat not possible now will be possible. And it just, people, I think, will enjoy that as much as the driving experience. And, you know, and I think there will come a point at which we'll say, you know, it's just too dangerous to drive. If you want that experience, hey, we've got a few highways we're keeping open for that out in Nevada. Go knock yourself out. But, you know, around here, you know, we're all auto-drive cars now. Now,
yeah.
Do I think that will happen right away? I think that people will hold on to the ability to drive probably 5 or 10 years after it's been demonstrably proven that that the cars are safer. I think people
yeah.
will just
and they'll
will
be
hang
the greatest risks.
It.
They will represent the greatest risks on the road.
I think my job is going to go away. A lot of ambulance drivers will be out of work. A lot of emergency rooms will have to cut their staffing, and quite frankly, good riddance to all of us. We'll have to find something else to do, and that's just a wonderful thing.
Well, much as I would hate to see you out of work, Stephen, I have to agree. It's just like
I'll find something else to do.
You know, it's like when we talk about nanotechnology replacing dentistry. You know, I like my dentist. But if her job didn't exist anymore because nobody's teeth ever went bad, the world's a better place, right? I mean, it's just
That's right.
You can't get around it. Yeah, I agree with you. Not just in the area of self-driving cars, but in all of these transformative technologies, people are going to see the benefits. They're going to want them. They're going to demand them. Ultimately, there's no stopping. You know, there's no stopping improved standard of living. There's no stopping a higher quality of life, which has a way of showing up.
That's a constant in human nature. We
yeah.
always want more. We always want better. You know, and you can call that greed, whatever you want to call it. You know, Gordon Gekko said greed is good. I think perhaps it is sometimes. It spurs us on to improve our surroundings, and that's kind of what I think that's what's going to happen. And no, I don't think there's any putting brakes on this.
I call it the human imperative, actually, that we're always
right.
seeking to improve our circumstances, and will continue to do so. Okay, so that you know, that does it for the declaration of singularity. Let's talk about some major improvements in our circumstances, or at least in our understanding of the universe that have occurred this week. Let's begin with the big science news story of the year, I'm going to say, if not the decade.
Maybe the decade. Yeah, maybe the
yeah.
decade.
One of the biggest stories of all time, and we've been tracking this for years on the show. We did a show about it just a few months ago when they were really beginning to close in. And I got to give a hat tip to Wayne Radinsky over on both on Facebook and on Google Plus. He has been doing yeoman's work tracking this thing, and I was getting all my updates from Wayne on we're this much closer, and then suddenly we're there. So what's the word, Stephen? What has occurred here with the Higgs boson? How is it that we know now that it exists? Do you know?
Well, it's just that many more observations. What they had was a really good idea. Looking at a certain frequency, a lot of this is outside beyond my level of knowledge of it. But they had an idea of where to look frequency wise to find this particle, and so
right.
they just kept doing collisions after collisions. My kids said it's a little bit like trying to figure out how a car works by crashing a bunch of cars together and then looking at the shadow of the pieces as they fly off, you know, and trying to figure out based on the pieces that are flying off the cars.
That
you know,
is a terrific analogy for the for the Large Hadron Collider, isn't it? That's really what we're doing. Yeah.
And trying to figure out how the car works based on the shadow of the pieces that fly off cars. Well, yeah, that's what we're doing here. We're bombarding these particles, watching what comes off, and trying to get an idea of it. And it's not just the Large Hadron Collider. There's a collider here in the United States that contributed as well. And so they took all these observations and they data mined it until they've reached a point that they can say with certainty, yes, we've got a particle. It is what we expect the Higgs boson to look like. It's the right weight. I think that's interesting that the particle that they believe grants mass to all the rest of the particles is itself the heaviest boson they've ever found, and if this is the Higgs boson, and that's the big if that's left. We've got a new particle, that's for sure. It's they found that 5 sigma, which means 5 standard deviations away from, you know, just being either or, you know.
Right.
It means we're very 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 certain that this is a new particle, and it's like 1 chance in 300 and something million. It was 300 something million. It was is what it was that this was just by chance with all these collisions. So they've got the particle, and they know a good bit about it. It appears to be the Higgs boson, so the question is what does this mean? And I would say the standard model of particle physics has been affirmed. At least,
right.
So, you know, we may learn a lot more beyond the standard model, but provided this turns out to be the Higgs, and we have every reason to believe it is, then the standard model is correct. We've got that much right. There's more to learn beyond that, but we've got this much right. So that's kind of a big deal. We potentially stand at the point where we're going to learn how particles acquire mass. You know, does that mean at some point that we can influence whether something is the mass of a particular object? I don't know, but obviously that would be a big deal, wouldn't it? I mean, what if we could have a spaceship, you know, that we removed 90% of its mass? How great would that be to launch something into orbit, Phil? If we were able to reduce its mass by 90%, you know.
Yeah. Well, what if you could reduce its mass by 100%? How fast could a thing with no mass go? Right. It seems like the whole Einstein thing gets recalculated at that point, right? Because there's always this assumption that mass is increasing as you. While we're on the subject, just to step back just for a minute for those who. Are late to the Higgs boson discussion. Did you see this picture that's been circulating? Live Science put it out. What is a Higgs boson?
I have not seen it. What does it show?
This is sweet. It's the cocktail party analogy. So this was obviously put together a while back.
I'm sorry, I saw that. Yeah,
yeah.
That is sweet. Go ahead.
They say the elusive Higgs boson, if found, would complete the standard model of physics. It is thought that matter obtains mass by interacting with the Higgs field. If Higgs did not exist, according to the model, everything in the universe would be massless. So nothing would work, right? Gravity wouldn't. I mean, I don't. It's weird to ponder. I don't think our universe would exist without mass. But here's the cocktail party analogy. Imagine a party where guests are evenly spaced around the room. The room of guests represents the Higgs field, which is everywhere in the universe. Suddenly, a celebrity enters. Guests notice the celebrity and rush in closer to be near her, forming a tight knot. As the celebrity passes through the room, the concentrated clump of guests surrounding her gives the group additional momentum. The clump is harder to stop that one guest alone is harder to stop than one guest alone would be, and so we can say that the clump has acquired mass. That's what the Higgs boson. It's like a celebrity showing up at a party and changing the distribution of the guests. I think that's a brilliant analogy and gives you at least a picture in your mind to help you understand this idea of this particle that is creating the momentum needed in order for mass to exist. And once we've isolated that particle and we're able to, you know, say that this is all occurring within this particular field, the possibility that we might be able to tweak that begins to arise, or that we might be able to manipulate it. We might be able to get benefits from that, that haven't even been imagined. Because the point is, until you know something exists, there's not an awful lot you can do with it. Once you've isolated it and begin truly observing it, you're in a much greater position to say what's the value of this. And I think it's safe to say that, well, it's at least entirely possible that huge benefits eventually can be reaped by our better understanding of the universe that's come about from the discovery of the Higgs boson. But what's left?
Absolutely.
Now the standard model of the universe is confirmed. We know everything, so there's nothing left to learn. You know,
shut down physics. There's no, you know, we don't have it. I you know, that's the deal. There's always more to learn. It doesn't stop being interesting, fascinating, because
well, we got a standard model, but we still don't have a unified field theory that everybody agrees on, right? So I think there's still plenty of work to be done. Okay, so you know what? There's several things I want to get to tonight, so we're going to move on from the Higgs boson, unless you had something else you wanted to say about it, Stephen.
No, that's.
Let's get to our either two or one amazing additional discoveries. I'm really interested to hear what yours is.
Okay. Same day as the Higgs boson is announced, okay, July 4th, okay, published in Nature, finger of universe dark matter skeleton, which dictates where galaxies form, has been observed for the first time. They've observed dark matter for the first time, and they decided to publish it on July the 4th.
Oh, wow.
So the same day that we got the Higgs boson, we got dark matter. It's been observed. Big, big, big deal, and nobody has heard about it because of the Higgs boson announcement. Even the people that are interested in science did not hear about it. You know, even the normal geeks did not hear about this. This was announced the same day. So, anyway, it's in the journal Nature, and the way they did it was pretty fascinating too. They had to find a galaxy group that was sort of on its side by, the way we were looking at it had to be that we were looking at it on edge all the way through it, okay? It's sort
right.
of a flat, you know, the structure of dark matter was flat and long, and we had to be looking down it from our point of view. And they searched the cosmos on what they were looking for, and they said, okay, we've got a galactic structure that's in a line moving away from us. Now let's see if we can observe the dark matter that's holding these this galactic group together, and they were able to do it, and they were able to show that they did their calculations on what matter there was that's visible and what wasn't, and you know, a vast majority of the matter in that galactic group was dark matter, and they were able to observe it and how it. And the structure that held it all together, very fascinating. I found that almost as interesting as the Higgs.
Well, it's you know, potentially as big a discovery, isn't it? I mean, this is what's interesting about this is it reminds me of that old chestnut about how celebrity deaths always occur in threes. Right. It seems like whenever a celebrity dies, there's only one or two other or two others that occur right around the same time. Well, maybe it's going to be that major physics discoveries are all going to occur in threes, right? And we got one more to come because it's pretty astounding that the Higgs boson is confirmed on the same day that they actually observe and confirm the existence of dark matter. That makes you think there's got to be one more big one. you know, that's about to show up. This has been an idea, a hypothetical form of matter that was posited to explain why the universe doesn't weigh as much as it does, right? That no one ever observed it before. No one could say there it is, but there were mathematical calculations that said, well, if something like this existed, it would account for why the universe behaves the way it does. It would account for why the galaxies move the way they do, and some of those kinds of phenomena. So our best guess is that that there's something out there called dark matter. These are its properties. They began to get more specific about the properties to the point where this is really interesting. They started knowing, or at least they had an idea of how to look for it, and then lo and behold, finally saw it.
Right.
That's astounding. Now, does dark energy come along for the ride or no?
No, it's a different thing. It's quite frankly, I don't understand dark energy. I don't understand dark matter that well, but I do know that it's a completely different thing. So, well, I guess we'll
all
see.
All right. Well, maybe it'll show up here in a few weeks, right? I mean,
yeah,
it could be the big third one.
The third thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody will prove that dark matter exists, but I'm holding out for the perpetual motion machine. Somebody invents one of those. That would be the big third huge discovery. Well, that's a really cool story, and I'm glad I had a different one. Mine would almost have justified dusting off the Tales of the Paranormal soundtrack, but not quite, because this is absolutely 100% true science. And I don't know if you saw this. Britain's Atlantis found at the bottom of the North Sea, a huge undersea world swallowed by the sea in 6500 BC. Did you hear about this?
I did not. Tell me more.
It's amazing. Apparently, about 8,500 years ago, this large tract of land that existed pretty much between Scotland and Denmark got overflowed by the North Sea and disappeared from the earth. But before that, that land was all connected. So Europe, the map of Europe would have looked significantly different than it does today, and there were tens of thousands of people living there. Divers have just begun to map this area out. They're finding riverbeds down there. Eventually, it's expected that they're going to find numerous human artifacts and evidence of, you know, these people who lived in this land that was once, you know, connecting these two completely separate places, and which is now at the bottom of the ocean. Obviously, the name Atlantis is apt because it's an area of land that was subsequently buried by the ocean. But this is, I think, is, you know, something that happened right around the same time. This would have been and should have been an enormous news story, and I think it pretty much got lost with, you know, people can only handle so much science news at any one time, and everybody was talking about the Higgs boson. But I expect we're going to hear an awful lot more about this. This is an amazing discovery about what the world was like not that long ago. I mean, not even 10,000 years ago, that basically the mainland of Great Britain was part of the European continent. I mean, a pretty astounding discovery that the connection between the two have been discovered, and I think we're going to learn quite a bit about what that has to tell us about who lives there now and how they got there and what the differences are between the people who live there. And also just goes to show you that there's still an awful lot to be learned, way out in space and deep within the smallest recesses of subatomic matter, but also just kind of on Earth at a macro scale, the world still has some major, major surprises to yield up to us.
I wonder what kind of artifacts they expect to find. I mean, is there going to be an underwater Stonehenge, perhaps, that they can come across? I mean, 8,500 years ago, that Stone Age culture.
Exactly
that
right. Yeah. That would not be completely out of bounds to expect something like that to be found. I think Stonehenge is about maybe 5,000 years ago, right? So this is a little bit older than that, but who knows? The point is, when you look at the map of it, they're calling it Doggerland. I don't know why, but basically, it's an area of land about twice the size of the British Isles. So England, Scotland, and Ireland, and the Orkneys, and all the rest of it. If you take that area and just about double it, right? It's like they've drawn this big red boundary around the British Isles, and they say this was all land. And you look at it and you go, and of course, England was connected to, I mean, Great Britain was connected to Lesser Britain, what they call Lesser Britain, Brittany in France, but also connected all the way over to Denmark. So it's a you know, imagine suddenly you have an area as big as all of Great Britain that was populated 8,500 years ago. Who knows what they're going to find there, right? I mean, it's
think about
it's
this.
Anybody's
guess. You must have had some ice age. You know, the Bering Strait, there was a land bridge at that time, in part because so much water was locked up in ice at the poles,
right,
that that the seas were lower, and therefore people could walk across from Russia to what is now Alaska, into the Americas, and that's how the Americas came to be populated. I wonder if it was something like that, or did we, or was there some sort of cataclysmic event where the land just fell into the sea? Did they say? Did they have an idea on that? Or
you know what? I haven't read that deeply, and I couldn't answer it. My guess is that it's probably just that a lot of ice, a lot of water that was locked up in ice on the land melted at the end of that ice age, and the sea level rose, and it just rose over this kind of low-lying land. I will report back. I'll read up and report back. We'll talk more about Doggerland in the near future. Okay, so those were our big discoveries. The other one I wanted to touch on real quickly was this something I had linked over on Facebook, New Approach to Water Desalination. And the only reason I wanted to bring this up is I think we had talked about this in conjunction with the discussion of the book Abundance.
Right.
This is talking about MIT researchers have come up with an approach using sheets of graphene, and basically they're talking about just filtering salt water into fresh water. Am I right? I didn't look back in Abundance to double check, but that was one of the big things that was discussed in that book.
And basically the idea is this, that you know, if we had a cheap way of taking out the salt out of the water. Yeah, desalinate. It would change the world. There'd be whole areas of, for example, you know, desertification of areas of Asia and of Africa, and even in places in the United States and in the western areas of the United States, that could be arrested if we had an abundant supply of water. And I think it would change the world. And so, yeah, that was a big part of Abundance. He spent a lot of time talking about new methods of doing it. So what have you learned?
This is one MIT is now saying, yep, we're ready. The technology exists. They're demonstrating it. Essentially, it's a nanotech filter, graphene filter. And basically, if you run salt water through it, fresh water comes out the other side. So this very complex process, complex and difficult process of desalination has been reduced to, yes, still a large challenge in terms of developing this thing in the first place and then manufacturing it, but it's now reduced to pushing water through a filter. If you can create sufficient pressure on the water and you have this filter, you can turn salt water into fresh water. So potentially, that future described in Abundance is upon us. Anyone, anywhere will be able to turn salt water into fresh water, and we'll have as much fresh water anywhere on the planet as we need, particularly anywhere near the ocean, because you know that's one of the great ironies of life is that a lot of people live near the sea and don't have any fresh water to drink. That's no longer going to be the case, and it's a tremendous game changer. Very exciting stuff.
Now, here's a quote that I know you've heard, and just see if you can name the person who said it. If we could ever competitively, at a cheap rate, get fresh water from salt water, that would be in the long-range interest of humanity, which would really dwarf scientific accomplishments.
Oh, who said that?
Yeah, who said that?
Sounds like something maybe Isaac Asimov might have said. I don't know, just wild guess.
John Kennedy, 1962.
Oh, okay, all right. So same era.
Well, what I find interesting about that is, you know, what is Kennedy known for? One of the many things he's known for is the space program. And here he's talking about, you know, if we could just get, you know, water cheaply, you know, that would dwarf anything else. And
well, it just goes to show you, President Kennedy was a real speculist, wasn't he? I mean,
yeah, he
you
was.
Know,
he saw the big
issues. He would have been delighted to read a book like The Rational Optimist or Abundance, I think.
Yeah.
Because his mindset was very much one of getting to the new frontier and making the world a better place. Well, the other item I wanted to get to tonight, and we're not going to have time for it, was to talk a little bit about not just Prometheus, but I thought we might hit on some of the other summer movies. We usually do a show about that around this time of year. So I think we'll put that off until next week. We've also got upcoming in the near future, we're going to be doing a show or two on the subject of H+, the digital series. I just saw that that's going to be released on YouTube August 8th. There's going to be a screening of the series in Los Angeles on Monday. I was invited to that, but I'm just not able to get away to go to it. But I'm hoping that a friend or two of mine in the LA area will be attending, and we might get a report back from one or both of them. If that happens, that'll be great. But even if we don't manage to pull that off, I think we're going to be doing a show with the creators of the series sometime between now and its launch on YouTube. So we got that that to look forward to as well. So, you know, some fun, entertaining shows coming up. Plus, we'll also be doing more shows on our favorite serious, speculous subjects. So what's our music this evening, Stephen?
A little palate cleanser tonight. I thought I'd bring out bluesy jazz kind of stuff. Tonight is Falling the Blue by Admiral Bob with the singer who calls herself Snowflake. So Admiral Bob and Snowflake singing Falling the Blue.
All right, Admiral Bob and Snowflake. I like the sound of that. All right, well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Always a pleasure talking with you. Thanks to all our friends in the chat room and to everyone listening to us live. Also, everyone listening to us via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week on the regular night, Wednesday evening at the usual time. Look forward to being with you all then. And until then, live to see it.
This feels like nothing I've felt before. Head over backwards.